Germany's governing coalition has fallen. Israel's prime minister has fired his defense minister. Where is all this political turmoil leading? Well, we'll find out that and more on today's Trumpet World. Hello and welcome to Trumpet World. It's been a big, dramatic week for world news and for fulfilled prophecy. We've been spending the last 4 years telling you to expect Donald Trump to be back in the White House. And now we've seen that happen, or that start to happen with the elections this week. And we've been saying that even as people have been writing his political obituary after January 2021, and now he's won. And obviously that is the big news of this week. But we're going to set that aside for this Week in Review show. We had not one, but two shows on Wednesday where we looked at that dramatic election. So you can go and look those up if you want to know more about it. We had one just talking about focusing on the fulfilled prophecy and what is next for America. And then we had another where I sat down with Joshua Michels and we talked more about, well, what's next for Europe and how is Europe already responding to these results. So those are both available on YouTube and Rumble and pretty much wherever you're watching or listening to this show. So go back to that. Instead, we're going to focus on some of the massive developments that have also happened this week that are on other areas, other continents even. And there's been more huge news this week that is not the US election. And the first of those that we're going to talk about is Germany. Germany's coalition government collapsed this week. You know, the return of Donald Trump, that's not enough for massive, prophetically significant news. And actually, Germany could be set to be leaderless, basically, for potentially a year. And that could be a huge development. That, look at everything that is going on. Look at all of the challenges that a Trump presidency presents to Europe. And as we talked about on that earlier show, heads are exploding across Europe. They're all kind of freaking out. And now Germany is entering where, at least if the Chancellor Scholz gets his way, an area where they have no real leadership for up to a year. The governing coalition collapsed Wednesday evening after Olaf Scholz fired his finance minister, Christian Lindner. So this has been a coalition that nobody has really liked right from the start. And the parties involved didn't want to be in the coalition, really. The voters didn't want to have them in coalition. The opinion polls have been against every party in the coalition and the coalition itself for quite some time. Unsurprisingly, this unstable coalition achieved very little, but they had managed to kind of hobble along, and Germany's next election was scheduled for September 2025. But they weren't able to just drag themselves over the finish line. Now, as with many breakups, the immediate cause for this breakup was a row over money. The coalition agrees that they want to spend more on defense. Just about all the German political parties agree on this. But the challenge is, where do you find the money to spend more on defense? And this is where it all fell apart. The Social Democrats, the largest party in this coalition, they want social spending. The Green Party, another big part member of the coalition, they want green spending. And then you have the Free Democrats, who basically want no spending. Their priority is low taxes, fiscal responsibility, low debt, not borrowing money, low taxation. And those are the ones in control of the purse string. So Lindner is their leader, and he's the finance minister. Now, what Scholz says that he wanted was for Lindner to declare a financial emergency. That would allow the coalition to get around the strict German constitutional limits on borrowing, because unlike most other democracies where we borrow like there's no tomorrow, Germany's a lot more responsible, and keeping that debt under control is a much bigger issue. And there's a constitutional responsibility to stay at least much closer to having a balanced budget. But, you know, the Green Party, the Social Democrats, they don't want to cut any spending. They want to take the easy way out and finance all of this extra money for defense from borrowing. And so they say, well, declare the state of emergency. Christian Lindner said, no, not going to do that. I'm not going to declare a state of emergency. He said it would be unconstitutional. He may well be right on that. In 2023, the German Constitutional Court ruled on a case about that where they said in a different case that declaring a state of emergency to get around the spending limits or the debt limits was unconstitutional. So he's probably right, and he refused, and Scholz fired him for that. Now, this does come amidst building divides in the German coalition. Like, people were asking this time last week whether the coalition government would survive. Then you had an internal letter or an internal plan from Lindner on what he would like to see for spending for the German coalition leak out. And it may well have been an accidentally on purpose leak from Lindner. We're getting towards the end of the coalition anyway. All of the different coalition members, they're seeing their popularity plummet. They're jockeying for position to try and prepare for that next election. So it may have been an attempt to differentiate himself from his coalition partners that they leaked this document. But this document basically called for a big cuts in green spending and lower taxes and using this to reinvigorate the German economy. That didn't go down well. That being made public within the German coalition government, that caused lots of problems. So that's the background to this firing. Now, for Germany, though, the ending of a coalition doesn't mean snap elections the way that it would in quite a lot of other countries. This kind of cycle of weak divided governments followed by snap elections, followed by another weak divided government, followed by snap elections. This is something that happened in the early 1930s. This is something that is seen as leading to the rise of the Nazis. So Germany's more modern post-war constitution gives minority governments quite a lot more control and makes it much harder to have snap elections or gives them more avenues to stay in power. So Scholz only needs to pass a budget to remain in office until September and have those regularly held elections. And he's appealed to his main opponent, the Christian Democratic leader Friedrich Merz, to help him do that, to help him pass a budget so that he can stay in office. And Scholz, even aside from that, is trying to play for time. He's kind of pushed back as much as possible the deadline for having a budget. And he's scheduled a confidence vote for January 15th. So if he fails in this confidence vote on January 15th, the government will fall and elections would be held probably in around March 2025. That's quite a long way into the future. Then you look at how divided the German electorate is according to the polls, and that no party has overwhelming support and no party has an easy path to a coalition. Last election, it took 2 months to form a coalition government. Before then, it took nearly 6 months to get a coalition government together. So coalition has fallen in November. Scholz doesn't want elections until March. You could easily have another 6 months of coalition negotiations. You could be looking at a year with no effective government in Germany. And certainly no government with any popular mandate to do anything radical. I mean, even until March, Scholz would still be the chancellor, but he wouldn't have a majority in the Bundestag. He wouldn't have the ability to take any big decisions. So you're looking at a leaderless Germany potentially for a year. I mean, can Germany afford to go that long with no real leadership? Well, Friedrich Merz, the likely next chancellor at this point and Scholz's main opponent, he doesn't think so. So he is really pressuring Scholz to hold a confidence vote much sooner. He sat down on Thursday with the chancellor, that's what he really tried to push for. And he's basically saying, look, Scholz, we're not going to help you at all if this is the plan, a January 15th date for a confidence vote and a March election. We're not going to participate. We're not going to be helpful. Now, if you bring that confidence vote much sooner and you hold elections much sooner, then, yeah, we'll be as helpful as we can in the interim and in maybe even passing a budget and keeping things ticking over. But our price is we want quick elections. But there's not much that Merz, I mean, that sounds very reasonable to me. There's not much he can do to force the issue, though. And the only way that the Bundestag can force a vote of no confidence on a reluctant chancellor is if they have a replacement chancellor waiting in the wings that's got the support of the Bundestag. Like, unless they can swap chancellors out and say, well, this guy has our support, they cannot hold a vote of no confidence. That's massive in terms of how the parliament functions, because it's quite easy to get a lot of people to agree and a majority to agree to say, we don't like this guy, much harder to get a majority to say, we do like this guy. It seems like that's almost certainly not going to happen. So if Scholz continues with this January vote of no confidence, March elections, coalition government going on for months after that, there's not much that anyone can do to force that to change. There might be some avenues where the German president could step in, but he's from the same party as Scholz. I don't think he'll do that, though it is possible, I guess, that there's some way he might get involved. And then fresh elections are probably not going to solve this divide. Remember, the fundamental trigger for the fall of this coalition is this question of where do we fund the extra defense spending from? I mean, that in itself, that Germany is so keen that spending more on defense is such a big issue for Germany that a government would fall over it. That in itself is big news. That in itself tells you that Germany is very keen on rearming. That in itself is important to watch. But that question of where does this money come from, that doesn't magically go away after an election. And there is no coalition where parties that agree on this question get a majority. Like, the CDU agrees with the Free Democrats. They say if there's any extra funding for defense, that has to come from cuts to other areas. So it may well, at the moment, the only real avenue for a coalition is a Christian Democrat, Social Democrat coalition post-elections. You've still got the same problem. You've still got the same divide. That's why I don't think you've got the potential for months of elections. And the reason for this, the reason why it's going to be so hard for anyone to have a coalition, is the rise of these fringe parties that people say, these are so extreme, we're not going to work with them. So the Alternative for Deutschland, that I think genuinely is a far-right party, not in the way that, I mean, we talk about this quite a bit on this show. They're not a Donald Trump-like party where they get called far-right, and they're very obviously not. They do have some leaders, not all leaders. They do have some leaders that genuinely are far right, that genuinely want a reevaluation of that see World War II, for example, as in a very different way, where the Nazis were not the bad guys of that war, and where everyone was kind of equally bad, and Germany unfairly got landed with the blame. That they have the support of 17% of voters, according to opinion polls. Everyone has said these guys are too extreme, we won't work with them. Well, okay, you leave that 17% out, that makes it very hard to get a majority. You add to that then the Left Party, that are the successors to East Germany's Communist Party. Most parties, certainly the Christian Democratic Union, that is set to get the most seats in the next parliament, they've said we won't work with them. Same with what's called the Sarah Wagenknecht Alliance, this split off from the Left Party. They've said we don't want to work with them. Well, now that's a quarter of the votes that you're not going to work with. You're trying to get a coalition that has a majority in the parliament that has 50%, and you've ruled out working with 25% of the groups. There's not much that you can do. So even once Germany has gone through what looks like months of coalition negotiations, you're still looking at a very weak, divided coalition that is not that different from the one that we've got in charge. I'm sure it will be a different chancellor. I'm sure it will be different parties to the one that we are now. But fundamentally, it looks like it's just going to be weak, divided, and it maybe might hobble on again for a little bit before collapsing if it got that far. And that's Germany's future. Weak, divided, unstable government as far as the eye can see. Is Germany going to stand for that? Can they afford that? Russia is fighting a land war in Europe. Israel is fighting wars in the Middle East. Iran is lashing out. Iran's proxy Hezbollah has been making threats against Cyprus, an EU member. And they're being taken care of by Israel right now, but that's the world that we live in. Armed terrorist groups backed by Iran threatening war with the European Union. That's basically what happened there over the summer. Donald Trump just won the US election, and he will not keep paying the bill for Europe's defense. That forces some hard decisions on these EU member states. And in all of those situations, and then there's the migration crisis, you've got migration uprising, you've got terrorism, you've got gang warfare exploding in France and in Sweden, and that can spread to Germany. I want to talk about that when I do my rundown of other news. But in all of these different crises, everyone turns to Germany. Okay, Europe, how do we respond to Donald Trump? Donald Trump has just put tariffs on our cars. How do we respond? Now, I'm not criticizing those policies necessarily, but I'm saying those are going to force decisions from Europe. All eyes turn for Germany, and Germany's like, now we're going to take the year off. We're done with politics for the next year. Like, can they get away with that? Germany is Europe's biggest, most powerful nation. And then they just want to spend the next year consumed with their own politics. I mean, we have warned for years. You go back to the plain truth. We've warned for decades about the rise of a strong man in Europe and how that will happen. I mean, talk about fulfilled prophecy. We saw that massive one with Donald Trump coming back. And this very, very, very likely is paving the way for a huge fulfilled prophecy, one of our most long-standing ones, that you would have the rise of a strong leader in Europe and that he would come about, that he's not just a democratically elected kind of strongman that has his term in office and that goes, that he's a fundamentally different type of leader and that he's going to come about potentially in an undemocratic way or an unusual way. And Mr. Flurry said that this leader could perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition. There's plenty of weakness in Germany's future. So this strong leader that's coming to Germany, he is a pivotal figure in world affairs. And just to look at one prophecy, Daniel 11, verse 21 to 31, it tells us how he's going to come into office. And many biblical commentaries will tell you correctly that this passage refers to ancient Antiochus Epiphanes. But he didn't fulfill all of these prophecies. He was a type. This Antiochus Epiphanes, he was a type of a modern strong leader that's going to come on the scene. And Daniel 11 and verse 21, it says, the people shall not give this Antiochus the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And the Jameson Fawcett Brown commentary, it says that this means that the kingdom, the nation shall not by public act confer the kingdom on him, but he shall obtain it by artifice, you know, by cunning, by artifice, by flatteries. Barnes notes, it says, in other words, it should not be conferred on him by any law of act or nation or in any regular succession or claim. It's an irregular way. It's not by coming to the people and winning a straightforward election and getting a majority of 50%. And Mr. Flurry wrote, even as far back as 2002, this man doesn't come to power the honorable way by being voted into office. He takes it dishonorably. He'll work behind the scenes and come to power by flatteries, not votes. You can see Germany having facing weakness and no leader for a year, you could really see why voters would say, well, we need to figure out a way to get a strong leader some other way. Like, we can't sit this year out. We need to do something. Maybe it's behind the scenes, no negotiations. Maybe we need to change our coalition, our constitution. You know, however it is, we need someone coming in here differently. And we've made this forecast before. We've made these statements before because Germany has faced weak coalition governments for years now. But that just increases the appetite of, okay, like, this is not a one-off. This is not a one-off situation. We were here in 2021. We were here in 2017. We've been here before. We can't just have an election and that fix it because it doesn't fix it. We need our strong leader. We need our own Donald Trump. And even more, you know, like, we need somebody that can go toe-to-toe there. We need something different. And the rise of the alternative for Deutschland shows that Germany is willing to embrace something very out of the ordinary to make that happen. If Germany remains politically paralyzed while troubles multiply at home and Europe burns, while it's really easy to see Germany clamoring for a strong leader. And I think it's the timing of all this that just makes this so especially interesting to watch. If you've read our free book, America Under Attack, you'd be familiar with this prophecy of an Antiochus. Yeah, there was this ancient Antiochus, and then there's several modern types that fulfill this Antiochus. That there was an Antiochus within God's church that fulfilled many of these prophecies in Daniel 8 and Daniel 11, in casting truth to the ground and turning God's church astray. That there would be a national Antiochus within the nation of America doing the same thing from within, and then finally there would be this Antiochus rise to the scene in Europe and take Europe in a radically different direction. And then we had that article that we talked about on Wednesday's show about Barack Obama fulfilling this role of Antiochus and that his power is being diminished. And Mr. Flurry was talking about this over the summer, and he said, you know, as you watch his power being diminished, we're seeing more of a focus shift to the rise of a European Antiochus, the rise of this European strongman. And so I think, you know, the election and Barack Obama impotently tweeting out, it's going to take days to count the votes, and then just hours later, all the votes are in and it's clear who the winner is. You know, that was the clearest evidence yet of his power being diminished and of his power disappearing before your eyes, as Mr. Flurry said it would happen. And then the same day that we get those election results, Germany's coalition falls apart. And watch for the rise of that European Antiochus. That very well could be the next focus for some dramatically fulfilled Bible prophecy. Your America Under Attack is a key book for exposing the Europe, that American Antiochus. We have a book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. That's a great place to go to understand what is happening in Europe. So you can watch this prophecy be fulfilled before your eyes. I mean, if you read America Under Attack, and if you were keeping up with our articles, this week was so exciting. Not necessarily because we're cheering on one political side or another, but because it's about fulfilled Bible prophecy and God's role in end time events and you being pointed towards God and seeing God's plan for mankind. And that, like, that was super exciting. Well, read A Strong German Leader is Imminent and you'll be able to do exactly the same thing for European news. And it's not just going to be a confusing, frustrating mess for the next year as Germany tries to get its act together. It will be God in action. You'll see God in world events. And it will show you how all of this is leading to God bringing the entire world to repentance and prosperity, just like we talked about on Wednesday's show. So I'd really encourage you to read that. A Strong German Leader is Imminent. And I did have a few other news stories from Europe to bring you in a quick rundown that we also want to make sure we talk about this week. So short, right before they fell, practically the German coalition government's last action was to sign off on a law that will compel young men to answer a survey about their willingness to serve in the German military. So this is about expanding Germany's military power. So 300,000 boys that turn 18 next year in Germany will have to fill in a questionnaire about how interested they are in serving in the German military. We've talked about this before, but it was approved this week. And young women will also have the option of filling out this survey. This will help Germany. This will help them recruit more people. And those that say, yeah, I am open to serving in the military, well, then I think they will be there as a potential to be conscripted. And they're looking at reintroducing conscription, even recruiting foreigners. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, was that deliberate? Did the German government kind of claw its way long enough to pass that law? I think that also shows how seriously they're thinking about defense within Europe. You had the story as well. This was from Tuesday, where German police arrested 8 members of a far-right neo-Nazi militant group. They had plans to take over the state using armed force. There were over 450 police officers and special forces involved in this, searching 20 premises. There were the Saxonian Separatists, founded about 2020. They've been called racist, anti-Semitic, partly apocalyptic. Their members have paramilitary training. And you know, this is a symptom. We're not expecting a group like this, like the Saxonian Separatists, to take over the German government. But when you have these fringe groups and people supporting these fringe groups, it is a symptom of how desperate people are to have some kind of change in government and something different to get them out of this leadership. And I think we saw discontent for their leadership also in Spain this week. So angry protesters in Valencia, they were throwing mud at the king, the queen, the prime minister. People were chanting murderers, murderers. This is over the response to the flooding in Valencia. You had well over 200 people killed in that flooding. It is, I think it's Europe's deadliest natural disaster, I think, since the 70s or 80s. So a major, major event, and there's a lot of dissatisfaction over people being slow to warn from the fleeing and the regional government not being quick enough to get response from the national government. And there's a lot of specific local issues here. But again, it's another symbol. It's another indication of people being very dissatisfied in their mainstream leaders, not just in Germany, but all across Europe. And you're seeing in France, I mentioned this story, where you had massive gang violence last Friday that is causing real concern in France. I mean, France's interior minister, he said after this that France faces a choice between general mobilization or Mexicanization of the country. Like, we need to call in the army or we're going to be overrun by drug gangs like Mexico is. A shocking event. There was a teenager left fighting for his life, 4 others seriously wounded. But there was a shootout between rival gangs that ended up involving several hundreds people in the city of Poitiers. So massive levels of violence there. I mean, this is causing real concern. And again, it's these are the kind of problems that you can see people saying, yeah, we need someone to solve our problems, and we're not going to be overly concerned about diplomatic or democratic niceties to get in someone to fix these problems. We have hundreds of gang members shooting out on our streets. We've got to take care of this. You know, that's understandable, but it's leading to this rise of a strong German leader that's going to transform Europe. So that really is an epic event going on in Europe right now. We also have some very big political events going on in the Middle East right now. And so we'll hear an update on these and on the big news from Israel from Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, so on Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu finally was able to get rid of one of his longest-lasting enemies and move the war there in a different direction. And by that, I mean his defense minister. So Tuesday was when he fired Yoav Gallant, who has been defense minister in Netanyahu's cabinet for more or less since the start, certainly the start of the war. He's lasted this long. Why did it take so long and why now? Well, on a video Netanyahu uploaded on his X account, we can play the B-roll footage for that. It's unfortunately in Hebrew, but a little small quote from that here. Between me and Defense Minister Gallant, significant gaps emerged regarding the management of the campaign, and these gaps were accompanied by statements and actions that contradicted government decisions and cabinet decisions, end quote. So, per to be expected, he was a bit vague on the details, but the gist is Gallant has basically, or Netanyahu is accusing Gallant of insubordination and being public about it for both the Israeli public and Israel's enemies to see. That's not a good mix, especially when you're dealing with a leader like Netanyahu, who is a very shrewd politician and knows how to outmaneuver his political enemies.
So in some ways, similar to Germany, minister being fired due to insubordination, refusing to do what the chancellor wants, and a much more serious situation in many ways, because Israel is at war while Germany isn't. Is this the end of the coalition for Netanyahu the way that it is for Germany, or what that picture going forwards?
I would actually disagree with you with something you said earlier, in the sense that it's not a more serious problem, because it's not going to mean the end of the coalition. Gallant is part of Netanyahu's Likud party, and he is a bit of a shall we say, a bit of a lone wolf within the party. It's like, for example, when the judicial reform bills were being passed before the war started, he was one of the lone dissenters within the party itself. Regarding the cabinet that Netanyahu mentioned, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who leads one of the major parties within Netanyahu's coalition, applauded the move. He's the national security minister in Israel. And also ties in with who's replacing not just Gallant, but also the follow-up effects of some of these cabinet reshufflings. Israel Katz, Israel's foreign minister, will be replacing Gallant as defense minister. He's a longtime Netanyahu loyalist, has been in Israeli politics for decades. He took over as foreign minister this year after ousting Eli Cohen, most likely due to, in part at least, Cohen announcing prematurely that Israel was making relations with Libya, which of course caused the Libyan government to deny that, and that caused a big fiasco that way. But the big thing to notice with this is not necessarily Katz taking over the defense ministry, but who's taking over from him as foreign minister, and that would be Gideon Sa'ar, who is a former Likud member, had a spat with Netanyahu a number of years ago, started his own party, joined the anti-Netanyahu bloc that ended up becoming the Bennett-Lapid government. He served as justice minister under that. That obviously collapsed when the war started. His party, as well as Benny Gantz's party, joined the war coalition as ministers without portfolio, as general right-wing parties to give their input as a united front. Those fell apart, but Sa'ar managed to eventually join the coalition again. And now he's going to be the new foreign minister of Israel, which in one sense gives him an incentive to stick on with the government, creating more of a united atmosphere, you could say.
So in Germany, they fire a minister and the government falls apart. In Israel, what you're saying is he fired a minister and the coalition is more stable now.
Yes, exactly.
So I just want to check. You mentioned Gideon Sa'ar. He used to be a Netanyahu member. He quit. He formed his own party. He went to that feels like that's a bit of a pattern with Benjamin Netanyahu. Yeah, he does often end up offending people, or he has these enemies that go off in a huff. Is his former defense minister, is there a risk of him doing the same? I mean, you mentioned he was kind of isolated in the party, so I guess that risk would be fairly minimal that he quits and forms his own party and takes some people with him.
It's too early to say. He has since come out and been a little more unhinged with his, or less reserved with his criticism of Netanyahu, calling him corrupt and whatnot. Regarding what actually divided them, the biggest, they haven't said, of course, but just from the history, most likely it has to do with Gallant's desire to move on with the war with Gaza, to get a hostage deal going, to focus everything on Hezbollah, move the IDF's focus there, while Netanyahu wants Hamas completely liquidated before that happens. Gallant was also seen as an important intermediary between Netanyahu and the Biden administration in trying to get the two sides together for weapons deals, or the Israeli government to accept American limits, etc. Just the fact that he has those links alone might suggest maybe this. It's not uncommon for this administration especially to be meddling in Israeli politics. And, I mean, for the Israel left's part, there are plenty of protesters on the street that are ostensibly coming out in support of Gallant. It doesn't really take them much to go out and protest against Netanyahu anyway. So you could very well see him split off and form his own right-wing, but anybody but Bibi party to replace what Sa'ar used to be. But even if that's the case, he wouldn't really have that much power, especially now that Sa'ar looks like he's going to stay. And for his part, he is generally more in line with Netanyahu's prosecution of the war than even Gallant himself was. So in this way, Netanyahu almost gets to have a more powerful ally, like replacing everything that, as you said, makes his coalition more stable.
It's almost a mirror image, I guess, of what we've seen in the United States over the last 3-4 years, where you've got these never-Trumpers. I mean, even J.D. Vance was pretty critical of Donald Trump before. Dropping that criticism and coming and being part of a coalition in terms of all political parties, are coalitions of people with different beliefs. Now we're seeing something similar happen in Israel with former enemies getting behind Netanyahu.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because Tuesday was also the day when the American election happened. And granted, this firing, there have been rumblings that something like this was going to happen for a while. There was rumblings that even Sa'ar was going to jump in somehow for a while. I'm not suggesting that this was specifically timed for the elections, but it is, at the very least, very interesting timing, especially considering the close relationship that Donald Trump had with Netanyahu when both of them were in office together. The fact that you had the Gallant dismissed the same day Harris lost the vote. We're not the only ones that noticed that. The Wall Street Journal had a headline claiming, quote, "In one day, two of the biggest breaks on Israel's Netanyahu disappeared," end quote. So with Gallant gone, with this division between the defense ministry and the prime minister's office gone, with, in Katz's case, somebody that's more firmly under Netanyahu's vision, and Sa'ar also being, I guess you could say, in that mold for the time being, you could see Netanyahu starting to hit the gas, so to speak, on the war a lot more than he's done before, especially now that he knows that Trump is coming back in, making statements like, if the hostages aren't back before I'm in office, Hamas is going to pay. And Trump, for his own part, has told Netanyahu, "I want you to finish the war, and I want you to finish it quickly, preferably before I come into office." In other words, the green light. Everything that Biden's been holding you back on, forget about it. Go full steam ahead. Let's get this over and done with as quickly as possible. You could very well see Israel take on a much more offensive posture with less strings pulling them behind, and B, Hamas, now that they know that their buddy in Washington is about to be gone soon, that their buddies, in, so to speak, in the Israeli government are going to be gone soon, they have a lot less leverage on Netanyahu now. They might be a little more malleable for a surrender agreement or something like that. And the reason I wanted to bring this up now is that this is something that we're watching for specifically between those two individuals, Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu, to almost synergize the revivals of both America and the state of Israel. a chapter that we went to plenty in the program you did about the election, 2 Kings 14, which speaks of there being no helper for Israel and that God saved Israel by the hand of Jeroboam. And we look at that as a prophecy of God using a certain individual under the prophetic parallel, I guess you could say, of the ancient king Jeroboam to save the nations of Israel, to save America specifically. And we identify that individual as being Donald Trump. Verse 28 of chapter 14 talks about Jeroboam warring to recover something. Our editor-in-chief has talked about him being deprived of the election in 2020 and warring to recover that. But it also mentions the state of, or the nation of Judah in that recovery, in that war. This is what our predecessor for covering the Middle East, Brent Noctegal, wrote in a January 2023 article for our print edition called Bibi is Back. Quote, Jeroboam II had an unusually close alliance with the Jewish king ruling from Jerusalem, King Uzziah. Both kings worked together, which was far from the normal state of affairs between the two kingdoms. A period of national power stabilized both nations. Clearly, the modern counterpart of this relationship was on display during President Trump's first term while Netanyahu was in power. Continuing on, Trump and Netanyahu worked together during the president's first term. And since President Trump is prophesied to return to office, was it God's will also that Mr. Netanyahu would once again lead the Jewish state? End quote. Tying back into what he was, what was stated here, just look at this. The same day of the election, Trump isn't even in office officially. It'll be a couple of months before that. And you get this news of a turnaround going on in Israel for the war effort. Like, in this case, warring literally with what's going on in America right now, with what's going on in Israel right now. I think this is the very, very first domino to fall of Israel and America. Again, both experiencing resurgence at the same time because of each other. And I'm sure in the days and weeks ahead, that state of affairs is only going to grow more and more, perhaps, like even with this example, before Trump even enters into office.
So I think we'll probably talk a bit more about the implications for the Middle East of a Trump presidency, probably on Wednesday's show. I'm saying probably because given all the news we've had this week, I don't want to rule out something else dramatically happening over the weekend or whatever, and we swerve and go in a different direction. But I think that would be great to get into more, but I'm glad you gave us that bit of a preview of just one way that this could really dramatically change that relationship going on there in Israel. You had a couple of other stories, I think, to give us a rundown of.
Yes, a bit more of an update on some of the long or general trends that have been hitting some of the regions in the Middle East. Israel, for its part, is still fighting its war with Hezbollah. It's still making repeated strikes into Lebanese territory, including this week hitting Beirut Airport, or a Hezbollah facility in that proximity, as well as the town of Baalbek, which is on the northeastern corner of Lebanon. It's quite far away from the front lines. It's famous for having a lot of Greco-Roman ruins there. But you're starting to see, even as Israel progresses its operations in the very far south of Lebanon, the whole country is still a battlefield. And Hezbollah, for its part, is continuing its saber-rattling, but while also calling for a ceasefire without mentioning anything about a Gaza ceasefire. So they look like they're very much in the weaker position with this. Speaking of saber-rattling, Iran is still threatening to respond to Israel's attack on it, which was Israel's response to Iran's attack. I read somewhere that given how much they're publicly saying this over and over again, it probably means they don't know how they're going to do it yet, but they don't want to kill the momentum and make themselves look weaker than
you think the nation doth protest too much.
Exactly. And one other note, this week, the Israeli government, or representative of the Israeli government, Gal Hirsch, has confirmed that there are hostage negotiations with Hamas going on to the point where the Israeli government is offering several millions of dollars in exchange for the release of the hostages, as well as safe passage for the people implicated to third-party countries. While Israel is certainly on the ascent, I guess you could say, with this war on terror, and this could very well be just another bait Israel's throwing out for Hamas to reject, so they could say, look, we're doing everything we can. But, I mean, the fact goes the hostages are still there, and the Israeli government is still being pressured to make some pretty serious compromises to get them back. How exactly it'll play out, again, President Trump mentioned that he'll intervene if this isn't sorted out before he enters the White House, remains to be seen, but there is still plenty of pressure, including and especially within Israel itself, for something to be sorted out with that.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. We'll move away from coalition chaos and potentially falling governments to turn instead to Jeremiah, where we'll hear about a major international agreement.
Yes, that's right. Japan and the European Union have just signed a sweeping defense agreement that significantly strengthens their military ties during this time of rising global tensions. This agreement promotes joint weapons production between Japan and Europe. It also creates avenues for cooperation in cybersecurity. It promotes military information exchanges. And probably most significantly, it establishes cooperation between the armed forces of Europe and Japan. That's through activities such as joint military exercises and port calls and things of that nature. So this is a sweeping agreement involving the militaries of Japan and Germany, as well as other EU nations. And you can see why Europe and Japan would want to build strong military ties at this time. They see Russia's increasing belligerence. Russia is on the borders of both Europe and Japan, so that's alarming to both of them. They also see China's increasing belligerence and China's increasing determination to take over vital shipping lanes that both Europe and Japan depend on. They also see the United States becoming more of a wild card in geopolitics. President Trump has made clear that he is unhappy with the current arrangements of America defending both Japan and Europe so much. And his focus on America first really makes them wonder if America can be relied on to come to their defense in the event of an attack. So there are plenty of understandable reasons why Europe and Japan would enter into this sweeping defense pact. But this move has alarmed some analysts because it wasn't that long ago that Germany and Japan formed a military pact. That's back when it was Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. And that last alliance ended up being a big part of the most catastrophic war in human history. So some onlookers today with this new defense pact, they're hearing some chilling echoes of that dark history. A publication called International Affairs wrote about this on Sunday. They call the new agreement a Brussels-Tokyo axis. And they write, quote, "The Brussels-Tokyo axis is reminiscent of the Berlin-Tokyo axis created during World War II by Nazi Germany and militaristic Japan, the organizers of that great war of the 20th century. Does this new military cooperation agreement between the EU and Japan mean that Europe intends to repeat the events of 100 years ago and once again lead Europe to collapse?" End quote. So there you go. Some real concern there from the International Affairs publication about this new Europe-Japan military pact and whether it could herald a repetition of the tragic history from the last century. So this new pact, it takes effect on January 1st, not even 2 months away, and we have a lot to keep an eye on there.
So it seems like this, like there's significant components for everyone involved. Like there's the alliance, the history that goes with that, the strength that that brings to both sides' militaries. It also seems like this is quite a big development both for Europe and for Japan. Like a lot of this, at least from what I read about it, like it talked about the naval component and European ships potentially sailing through the Strait of Taiwan or having more to do with Asia. That's a pretty big step up for post-war Europe, where most of the military was very deliberately confined to Western Europe, initially to keep the Soviets out of Western Europe. And then even as it expanded, it was still primarily focused on the Mediterranean, the Middle East, the Balkans. This is really going to help them develop a global capacity, get them a lot more practiced and even a lot more kind of logistical support in moving around the world. And then you've got Japan with their pacifist constitution now making a military alliance with a military power halfway around the world from them. And we've already seen the way that international military contributions have played a massive role in what is basically Japan breaking its constitution or breaking out from those constitutional restraints on its military and deploying its military abroad, where it said, well, yes, we're going abroad, but it's as part of a UN peacekeeping mission. Or even they've looked at, okay, yes, we're patrolling abroad, we're patrolling the seas around the Middle East or the Bab el-Mandeb into the Red Sea, but we're doing that as part of a US-led international mission. And it seems to me this could be a quite a significant step forwards in that direction for both these powers.
I think that's exactly right. This is not only significant because it brings Europe and Japan together, but it's also happening at a time when both of these power blocks are greatly increasing their individual abilities. You know, Japan especially has been ramping up defense spending year after year for close to a decade now, building all kinds of cutting edge weaponry. And it does seem like you see a pattern here with both of them sort of being prepared to defend themselves and recognizing that they can no longer rely on the United States and just taking some concrete measures for a future when that can't be depended on.
So this development of the two of them moving together, I think like we're told with Mihailo, because we talked about something with when we were talking about him with Netanyahu that kind of touches on the US election. I think it'd be great if we can have a whole show next week where we talked already with Joshua on Wednesday about the Trump election and Europe, talking about Asia and the Middle East. I think we could get into that more, I think, on Wednesday and talk through all of the different ramifications of how this impacts the world, how the world is responding. But this is a trend that we've been watching for long before this particular US election, because of specific Bible prophecies.
That's exactly right. Yes, it was around 2,700 years ago that God inspired the prophet Isaiah to write about a massive anti-American trade bloc that would be formed in our lifetimes. Isaiah 23, verse 3 calls this a mart of nations. And verse 1 of that chapter says that one of the leading countries in this international trade bloc will be a power called Tarshish. It talks about the ships of Tarshish there. And that is one ancient name that the Bible sometimes uses for the people that make up modern Japan today. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury explains this in his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, which you can order a free copy of if you visit thetrumpet.com. But then Isaiah 23:1 also names Tyre, a power called Tyre, as one of the other main nations in this Mart of Nations block. And Mr. Fleury explains that this city represents the commercial center of modern Europe. So Europe and Japan, you know, that those are the two powers that we see among some others as well that are in these passages. And I think that seeing Japan and Europe linked together in these ancient prophecies, and then seeing this sweeping new defense pact binding these two modern countries together, it's very striking. And even more striking is what the Bible shows that the Mart of Nations will do in the years ahead. I'll just read a quote here from Mr. Fleury's booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision. It says, "The Bible contains many prophecies of that European power attacking America and many other prophecies of America being besieged," end quote. And then he explains that this besiegement will not be accomplished by Europe alone, but by Europe working with the other nations in the Mart of Nations alliance or trade bloc there. So it's a very sobering prophecy, and it means that those concerns about a repetition of the tragic events of last century with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, it means those concerns are entirely valid. But there's also a great deal of good news really wrapped up into this, right at the heart of these developments. So if you would like to understand more about the Mart of Nations and the good news that's tied into all of this, I hope you'll order your free copy of Mr. Fleury's booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision.
Well, you can put a link to that in the show notes. along with some of those other books that we've mentioned today, like A Strong German Leader, is imminent. You can get all of those. We'll have the link in the notes. You can just click on, we'll take you straight there. You can get them from our website, thetrumpet.com. And we would be very happy as well for you to order your own free print copy that you can go over and, you know, write notes in or mark up or turn to the Bible alongside. And having it in black and white and print facilitates that and helps, I think, lead to get to really dig into some of this material. So a big development going on in Asia. There were some other quick bits that you wanted to run down as well.
Yes. First, a quick Russia story. The Wall Street Journal reported Monday that Russian operatives placed incendiary devices on airplanes that were heading to the U.S. and Canada. And the aim was to detonate them and set fire to the planes once they reached those countries. These were with the DHL shipping service, and both of these devices ended up exploding early at DHS logistics hubs in Germany and in Britain.
Yeah, one of them would have been our local hub, probably.
Oh, really?
Right, in Birmingham, I'm sure we get many things that we get from DHL probably come through there. So we could have missed out on parcels because of that. But, you know, like you say, it could have been much more serious than blowing up a few parcels in the depot had it happened on an aeroplane.
That's right. Yes. And it does look like, from what we can tell, this was just kind of a small scale test run for possibly larger future attacks along these lines. And of course, Russia denies all involvement, but the fingerprints apparently of Russian spy services are all over this. And it shows just how incredibly belligerent the Russians are becoming, just trying to find all kinds of surreptitious ways of attacking Western nations. And then another quick story here about the rapid increase in China's space-based military capabilities. There was a report about this a couple of days ago from General Chance Saltzman, head of the U.S. Space Force. He was analyzing China's satellite-killing weapons. They've got weapons now on the ground that can take out satellites, and they also have weapons already in orbit, you know, satellites up there that can destroy other satellites. And General Saltzman said the speed with which China is building all this weaponry is, quote, mind-boggling. And he said the number of different categories of space weapons that China has created and the speed with which they're doing it is very threatening, end quote. So we know that America is more vulnerable to these kinds of weapons than any other nation by a long shot. We have more satellites in orbit than anyone else, and we depend on them militarily and in, you know, a whole range of other ways, far beyond any other nation. So it is alarming to hear about China's buildup of these weapons that is happening at a mind-boggling speed.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And that brings us nicely round to the United States, where I did say early on we weren't going to talk too much about the U.S. election because we did devote quite a bit of time to that on Wednesday. But of course, there have still been important developments that have happened since Wednesday that we would like to update you on. And so here to do that, we're joined with Andrew Miller.
Yeah, just to catch everyone up for the maybe the few people who haven't been watching the election, Donald Trump did win the U.S. presidential election in a blowout victory. They're still counting votes in Arizona and Nevada. They should have those by the end of the week, but no one expects them to go to Harris. So that's going to give him 312 votes in the Electoral College. And it looks like he's going to win the popular vote by about 5 million, which is important because that gives you like a huge mandate for now, like any disagreements you have with the left coming forward. I mean, you can definitely say that, like, not only did I win the constitutionally charted path to the presidency, but like I won a majority of the American people who support my vision for the country. In the couple days since the election, we've gotten a little bit more information on the Senate races, which are going to be pretty important as well, showing that it actually does look like the Republicans are going to win the Senate with about a 54 or 55 majority. They've already got 52 seats in the bag, but there's three races outstanding. And a good chance that they could win all three of those as well, which will be important because there's always one or two Republicans that side with the liberals on contentious vote. So having that 55-part majority also really strengthens Donald Trump's mandate. The one bit of information I was hoping to be able to report today and can't quite say conclusively is the House of Representatives. Analysts say there's about a 93% chance the House of Representatives is going to go Republican as well. But there's still a few outstanding races. But by all accounts, by the end of the week, there's about a 93% chance that the incoming Trump administration will have Republican control of the executive branch of government, Republican control of the judicial branch of government, Republican control of both houses of Congress, so the legislative branch of government, and a Republican mandate from the majority of the American people, showing that there's going to be a pretty good time of some like decisive action, at least for the next 2 years till midterms. We'll see what happens then. Where not only do you have a Trump return, but you've got his movement dominating every branch of the American government after what seems like about 16 years of like leftist domination of those branches.
And this is something that was prophesied that if you want to hear more about that, we talked about that quite a bit on Wednesday's show. Of course, the Trumpet Daily keeps you up to date every day with all the latest from American political news and other important stories. This is Stephen Flurry. You can look that up on Rumble on our website, thetrumpet.com. And it's just there have been some very exciting programs coming out of there over the well, they're always exciting, but it's when with all of this fulfilled prophecy, it's been really exciting to watch this past week or so.
The election stories this week are dominating people's attention. There's I guess an economic news in the United States. There's a little bit of uncertainty right now as the investors are concerned about Trump's tariffs plan. So interest rates have ticked up a little bit. Mortgage rates have ticked up a little bit. Treasury bond yields are going up a little bit as people are wondering what's going to happen financially with those Bible prophecies about the resurgence and saving America temporarily. I think it's pretty safe to say that regardless of like some of the Wall Street investors' concerns, not knowing exactly what's happening now, that those concerns are going to settle down in the months ahead.
So we'll keep an eye on Wall Street, I guess, and see what goes on with that. But a lot of victories for Donald Trump this week. I think I also saw that Jack Smith shutting down his prosecutions of Donald Trump. All of these different lawfare cases are closing down. I mean, like we talked about on Wednesday, this is so in so many different ways. You're seeing Barack Obama's power diminish before your eyes. And like we talked about, that is all fulfilled prophecy. Well, thank you so much to all of our guests today. Thank you, the viewer, the listener, no matter how you're joining us. Very glad to have you. Thank you for following up on some of those other stories as well happening around the world. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. If you have any questions or comments, please do shoot us an email at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com or leave a comment below the video. We will be back on Wednesday with more of the international implications of Donald Trump's win. And until then, keep watching your world.